Happy Saturday and welcome to the Jeremiah Patterson Show. Thank you for joining me this weekend. This weekend, we will be producing three different shows, one today, one tomorrow, and one on Monday. There is a lot to get to, otherwise I wouldn't normally do that. But of course, these are busy times. We're going to start tonight with one of the leading stories in the nation right now. On Tuesday of this week, the House Judiciary Committee, chaired by Jerry Nadler, released their impeachment report on Donald Trump. And I was wondering if they were going to do this because we expected this to be an expeditious impeachment, but we do have the report. It is 74 pages. I read the full report last night. However, if you are just reading the report and not the links and sources, then it's just 50 pages. In the report, it cites some text from the articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. Here's the introduction. It's pretty straightforward. Quote, "The Constitution grants the House of Representatives the sole power of impeachment, not merely as a safeguard for the nation between elections, but also in cases where the removal of a president is urgent and necessary to preserve the security of the constitutional order. The House must invoke this power now to impeach President Trump for inciting an insurrection on January 6, 2021. President Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors when he urged his supporters to storm the United States Capitol building and then failed to stop the ensuing violence. His actions marked the culmination of an extensive and unprecedented effort to overturn the results of the presidential election. As alleged in the article of impeachment and described in this report, President Trump has acted in a manner grossly incompatible with self-governance and the rule of law. His continued hold on office of the presidency, even for only a few more days, represents a clear and present danger to the United States. President Trump has engaged in a prolonged effort to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election and maintain his grip on power. He has spent months spreading disinformation about the results, falsely claiming that he won by a landslide, that the election was being stolen, and that the reported results are somehow fraudulent. He has stated that it would be illegitimate to accept the results of the election as certified by state officials and upheld by state and federal courts, and he has implied that accepting those results would pose an existential threat to the country, its democracy, and the freedom of his political supporters." End quote. So this is just half of the opening introduction from this House impeachment report. We know that the only article of impeachment against President Trump, which was the reason why he was impeached, was incitement of insurrection. In this new report by the House Judiciary Committee, it lays out everything in chronological order. For instance, here is the table of contents of the report, just laying out some key parts here and what will be discussed in this report. Quote, introduction, factual background. A. Conduct leading up to January 6, 2021. B. The January 6, 2021 Save America rally. C. The attack on the Capitol. D. President Trump's response to the insurrection. And E. The events of January 6 were a result of and incited by the president's course of conduct. End quote. In this new report by the House Judiciary Committee, it lays out how President Trump pressured public officials to overturn the results of elections in their state. It also points out that the president's mendacious statements about the election and how he encouraged his supporters to obstruct the peaceful transition of power. Also, how President Trump pressured Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the results of the election. But here's one more thing that's in this House Judiciary Committee report that I think is worth pointing out. Quote, "When the president concludes that elections threaten his continued grasp on power and therefore seeks to corrupt or interfere with them, he denies the very premise of our constitutional system. The American people choose their leaders. A president who wields power to destroy opponents or manipulate elections is a president who rejects democracy itself." A president who rejects democracy itself. You know, that statement is essential, especially when it comes to thinking about our democratic republic. If a president is rejecting democracy and embracing authoritarianism, autocracies, and dictatorships, well, what does that do to our democratic republic? What does that do to our constitutional system? Well, it weakens it, especially when members of his own party and members of a major political party are aiding and abetting his behavior. When I reflect on what happened at the Capitol 10 days ago, or you could just say last week, I think about Timothy Snyder's book, On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. This is chapter 17. Quote, Listen for dangerous words. Be alert to the use of words for extremism and terrorism. Be alive to the fatal notions of emergency and exception. Be angry about the treacherous use of patriotic vocabulary. End quote. Here's another one that I think is relevant right now. This is chapter 18. Quote, be calm when the unthinkable arrives. Modern tyranny is terror management. When the terrorist attack comes, remember that authoritarians exploit such events in order to consolidate power. The sudden disaster that requires the end of checks and balances, the dissolution of opposition parties, the suspension of freedom of expression, the right to a fair trial, and so on, is the oldest trick of the Hitlerian book. Don't fall for it. End quote. And of course, what happened at the Capitol on January 6th was not unthinkable, nor was it surprising or, oh my gosh, it's astonishing. Who expected that to happen? But we could have been more prepared for what happened at the Capitol. On Wednesday, the president was impeached for the second time, becoming the first president to be impeached twice in U.S. history. This was one of the most bipartisan impeachments in U.S. history, with 10 Republicans voting with the Democrats on this. This will now go down in U.S. history as one of the most bipartisan impeachments. Of course, President Bill Clinton was impeached. Democrats joined Republicans during that occasion. Another president that was impeached was Andrew Johnson. That was back in the 1860s for firing his Secretary of War, also continuing to clash with the Republican-controlled Congress. But neither presidents were convicted. And it does seem like there is a possibility that that could happen this time. These impeachment articles will now go to the Senate, where Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell plans to begin the trial on January 19th, one day before Joe Biden is sworn in as the 46th president. In this case, we will see what happens, but we do know that if the Senate convicts President Trump, there will be an immediate vote on if he should ever hold public office again. Of course, many constitutional experts are saying that this sort of conflicts with the 14th Amendment, which states that, quote, no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as any officer of the United States or as any officer's office of the United States or as a member of any state legislator, the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, but Congress, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. End quote. So many constitutional experts are citing, of course, the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which essentially bans people from public office for inciting an insurrection or aiding and abetting those who engaged in the insurrection. So that is a prospect that we are looking forward to as we continue to watch this. We do know that if the Senate does convict President Trump, as I said, there will be that vote to essentially see if he can ever hold public office again. That vote will only require a majority and not 2/3 of the Senate, like it does for impeachment and other legislative agendas. Today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell urged a vote of conscience for senators when the trial comes to the Senate, when they ultimately take that vote. The day after the domestic terrorist attack transpired at the Capitol, the Associated Press published a harrowing news report about the Capitol Police. The article reports on how the Capitol Police rejected offers of federal assistance to quell the mob at the Capitol. Quote, 3 days before supporters of President Donald Trump rioted at the Capitol, the Pentagon asked the U.S. Capitol Police if it needed National Guard manpower. And as the mob descended on the building Wednesday's, Justice Department leaders reached out to offer up FBI agents. The police turned them down both times, according to senior defense officials and two people familiar with the matter. End quote. Then on Tuesday, Devlin Barrett and Matt Zapodisky at the Washington Post broke an exclusive story about the FBI. Quote, FBI report warned of war at Capitol, contradicting claims that there was no indication of looming violence. The article continues, quote, "A day before rioters stormed the Congress, an FBI office in Virginia issued an explicit warning that extremists were preparing to travel to Washington to commit violence and, quote, war, according to an internal document reviewed by the Washington Post that contradicts a senior official's declaration that the Bureau had no intelligence indicating anyone at last week's demonstrations were in support of President Trump and that they planned to do harm. A situational information report approved for release the day before the U.S. Capitol riot painted a dire portrait of dangerous plans, including individuals sharing a map of the complex's tunnels and possible rally points for would-be conspirators to meet in Kentucky, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and South Carolina and head in groups to Washington. Quote, as of 5 January 2021, FBI Norfolk received information indicating calls for violence in response to unlawful lockdowns to begin on 6 January 2021 in Washington, D.C., the document says. Quote, an online thread discussed specific calls for violence to include stating, be ready to fight. Congress needs to hear glass breaking, doors being kicked in, and blood from their BLM and Pantifa slave soldiers being spilled. Get violent. Stop calling this a march or rally or protest. Go there ready for war. We got our president. We get our president or we die. Nothing else will achieve this goal. End quote. The warning is the starkest evidence yet of the sizable intelligence failure that preceded the mayhem, which claimed the lives of five people. Although one law enforcement official speaking on the condition of anonymity to avoid disciplinary action said the failure was not one of intelligence, but of acting on the intelligence. At the FBI office in Norfolk, the report was written within 45 minutes of receiving the information, officials said, and shared with counterparts in Washington, D.C., end quote. So this is just absolutely striking. It also it also states in that Washington Post report by Devlin Barrett and Matt Sapotsky at the Washington Post that the Capitol Police Chief said that he never received any indication of that report. He said if he did, they would have taken that earnestly and moved and acted on it. But apparently he has not received that report. As this official says, this was not an act on a failure of intelligence, but it was a failure on acting on the intelligence once it was received. And of course, they say that it was distributed to their counterparts in Washington, D.C. On Tuesday, D.C. Acting Attorney Michael Sherwin, along with a local FBI official, held a press conference speaking about the Capitol attack and how they would go as far as prosecutions. He essentially said that they were going to they got together a task force of national security prosecutors and public corruption prosecutors.
Just yesterday, our office organized a strike force of very senior national security prosecutors and public corruption prosecutors. Their only marching orders from me are to build seditious and conspiracy charges related to the most heinous acts that occurred in the Capitol. And these are significant charges that have felonies with prison terms of up to 20 years.
That was, once again, the D.C. acting attorney Michael Sherwin, along with the local FBI official, holding that press conference on Tuesday of this week. And now, I want to point out something that Rachel Maddow actually pointed out on MSNBC on her show. If you heard what he said there, he said, we have national security prosecutors and public corruption prosecutors. Ostensibly, if you need public corruption prosecutors in a case like this, then that may be a hint that someone in the public... A public official may be looking at, prosecutors may be looking at charging a public official in relation, or public officials in relation to the attack at the Capitol. Last week, all 10 former living defense secretaries wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post that the military needs to stay out of this election. I'm not sure if you read this, but here it is. Quote, as former Secretaries of Defense, we hold a common view of the solemn obligations of the United States Armed Forces and the Defense Department. Each of us swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We do not swear it to an individual or party. American elections and the peaceful transfers of power, that result of our hallmarks of our democracy, with one singular and tragic exception, that the cost of lives of more Americans than all of our other wars combined. The United States has had an unbroken record of such transitions. Since 1789, including in times of partisan strife, war, epidemics, and economic depression. This year should be no exception. Our elections have occurred. Recounts and audits have been conducted. Appropriate challenges have been addressed by the courts. Governors have certified the results, and the Electoral College has voted. The time for questioning the results has passed. The time for formal counting of the Electoral College votes, as prescribed in the Constitution and statute, has arrived. As senior Defense Department leaders have noted, quote, there's no role for the U.S. military in determining the outcome of a U.S. election. Efforts to involve the U.S. armed forces in resolving election disputes would take us into dangerous territory. Unlawful, and unconstitutional territory. Civilian and military officials who direct or carry out such measures would be accountable, including potentially facing criminal penalties for the grave consequences of their actions on our republic. Transitions, which all of us have experienced, are a crucial part of the successful transfer of power. They often occur at times of international uncertainty about U.S. national security policy and posture. They can be a moment when the nation is vulnerable to actions by adversaries seeking to take advantage of the situation. Given these factors, particularly at a time when U.S. forces are engaged in active operations around the world, it is all the more imperative that the transition at the Defense Department be carried out fully, cooperatively, and transparently. Acting Defense Secretary Christopher C. Miller and his subordinates, political opponents, officers, and civilian servants are each bound by oath, law, and precedent to facilitate the entry into office of the incoming administration and to do so wholeheartedly. They must also refrain from any political actions that undermine the results of the election or hinder the success of the new team. We call upon them in the strongest terms to do so, as so many generations of Americans have done before them. The final action is in keeping with the highest traditions and professionalism of the U.S. Armed Forces in the history of democratic transition in our great country. End quote. So that was a letter written by all 10 former living U.S. defense secretaries. Well, this week, we got sort of like a follow-up, but this one was from the letter of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's completely unprecedented letter. It reads, quote, "The American people have trusted the armed forces of the United States to protect them and our Constitution for almost 250 years. As we have done throughout our history, the U.S. military will obey lawful orders from civilian leadership, support civil authorities to protect lives and property, ensure public safety in accordance with the law, and remain fully committed to protecting and defending the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. The violent riot in Washington, D.C. on January 6, 2021 was a direct assault on the U.S. Congress, the Capitol building, and our constitutional process. We must mourn the death of the two Capitol policemen and others connected to these unprecedented events. We witnessed actions inside the Capitol building that were inconsistent with the rule of law. The rights of freedom of speech and assembly do not give anyone the right to resort to violence, sedition, and insurrection. As service members, we must embody the values and ideals of the nation. We support and defend the Constitution. Any act to disrupt the constitutional process is not only against our traditional values and oath, it is against the law. On January 20th, 2021, in accordance with the Constitution confirmed by the states and the courts and certified by Congress, President-elect Biden will be inaugurated and will become our 46th Commander-in-Chief. To our men and women deployed at home, safeguarding our country, stay ready, keep your eyes on the horizon, and remain focused on the mission. We honor your continued service in the defense of every American. signed by the Joint Chiefs of Staffs, end quote. When the attack occurred at the Capitol last week, we later received reports that some military members were at that Capitol. According to Bloomberg News, the U.S. Defense Department is known is essentially doing everything they can to find extremism within their ranks. The inauguration is in 4 days, January 20th, and not since the Civil War has the National Guard been inside our nation's capital. In receiving these letters from all 10 former living defense secretaries last week before the insurrection transpired at the Capitol, and this week after the insurrection transpired at the Capitol by the Joint Chiefs of Staffs, I mean, this is diametrically unprecedented, but it is also an alarming and imperative moment in American history. As we are watching this, former military officials and current military officials are saying, we are going to stay out of this election. We are urging our people within our ranks to stay out of this election. And on January 20th, 2021, Joe Biden will be sworn in as the next president of the United States. So all of this is happening at once. We know that more than 20,000 troops are there tonight, are at the Capitol, sleeping on the floor, and others are protecting the perimeter around the Capitol as they exchange and take time going back and sleeping and then coming back to protect. Reportedly, a local pizza company in Washington, D.C., called We the Pizza, has delivered 150 pizzas to the National Guard inside the Capitol right now and 700 pies. There's also a section on their website where you can find out where you can fill out a form and donate a pie to the National Guard for only $12. I'll make sure to link that in the description of this episode if you'd like to take part in that or share it with others. The CEO of the company said, quote, "We wanted to help, so we matched the order. Then we realized we weren't even sending nearly enough, so we just started donating to the troops," end quote. As of today, the Illinois National Guard is addressing a role that they might play in defending their state capital. Reportedly, hundreds of National Guard troops are leaving Massachusetts to head to the United States Capitol in D.C. Here in South Carolina, we have just deployed 650 troops to D.C. To protect the Capitol. According to Dan LaMuth at the Washington Post, he spoke with the D.C. National Guard commanding general today, and he expressed that the local officials trusted him. Major General William J. Walker said, quote, "I have all the faith and trust and confidence in the District of Columbia, from the mayor down to the chief of police, and I believe they trust me," end quote. Earlier this week, the FBI warned that the violent demonstrations essentially could be taking place this weekend at all 50 state capitals. We, of course, will bring that to you as we continue to watch this story develop. Earlier today, the Washington Post reported that a Virginia man was arrested at an inauguration checkpoint after weapons were discovered in his vehicle. Quote, "A Virginia man was arrested after law enforcement found at least one firearm and ammunition in his truck as he tried to enter an inauguration security checkpoint near the U.S. Capitol on Friday evening with a credential that was not authorized according to court documents. Wesley Allen Brown, 31 years old, of Front Royal drove his car up to a checkpoint on East Street, northeast of the U.S. Capitol, where he was met by Capitol Police officers, according to the court documents. The area is one of the many under complete lockdown following the January 6th breach of the Capitol and ahead of the January 20th inauguration. Beeler was arrested on charges of carrying a pistol without a license, possession of an unregistered firearm, and possession of unregistered ammunition," a Capitol Police spokesperson said. At a hearing on Saturday afternoon, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District asked a judge to issue a stay-away order. Beeler was released on personal recognizance, which prosecutors did not object to, even when the judge asked three times whether the government wished him to be held ahead of trial, end quote. I'll make sure to link that in the description of this episode. More members of Congress are expressing concern about their safety. NBC News reported earlier this week that Democratic members of Congress are afraid that their Republican counterparts might murder them. One of the voices this week that we heard from was the very influential young Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a very popular member of Congress, or better known by her initials as AOC. This was her speaking earlier this week.
Many members of Congress were almost murdered. Many congressional staffers were almost killed. As for myself, I had a pretty traumatizing event happen to me. And I do not know if I can even disclose the full details of that event due to security concerns, but I can tell you that I had a very close encounter where I thought I was going to die. And you have all of those thoughts where, you know, at the end of your life, and all of these thoughts come rushing to you. And that's what happened to a lot of us on Wednesday. And I thought I did not know if I was going to make it to the end of that day alive. And it is not an exaggeration to say that many, many members of the House were nearly assassinated. It's just not an exaggeration to say that at all. We were very lucky that things happened within certain minutes that allowed members to escape the House floor unharmed. But many of us nearly and narrowly escaped death.
Once again, that was Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez expressing concern about her life. Just a note here, the music in that video was not part of the original live stream. I watched the original live stream on YouTube. I'll make sure to put that in the description of this episode. That was, of course, incorporated by the Now This Use YouTube channel when they did their editing for that video. But you heard her say there that she thought that she was going to die and that her own members, that her own colleagues, her own Republican colleagues might expose her location for people to harm her. It's just unsettling to hear that, but that this is the traumatizing event that she and others went through during that lockdown. Earlier this week, Democratic Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill said that she saw some of her Republican colleagues giving reconnaissance tours inside the Capitol, showing around groups the day before the attack. We are learning more and more as this story continues to progress. We are in the earliest stage of accountability with mass arrest and inevitable prosecutions. According to Alice Sperry at The Intercept, the Department of Justice is considering charging Capitol rioters, with seditious conspiracy, felony, and murder. On Friday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had a message for any members of Congress who were involved in the Capitol attack. This is what she said.
When we're talking about security, we have to talk about truth and trust. In order to serve here with each other, we must trust that people have respect for their oath of office, respect for this institution. We must trust each other, respecting the people who sent us here. We must also have the truth, and that will be looked into. If in fact it is found that members of Congress were accomplices to this insurrection, if they aided and abetted the crime, there may have to be actions taken beyond the Congress and in terms of prosecution for that.
Once again, that was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking on Friday about the attack on the Capitol and members of Congress who, if you did, in fact, aid and abet this attack, actions may be taken beyond the Congress in terms of criminal prosecution. As I said, we are still in the early stage of accountability, but if we truly want to unify as a nation, accountability must come first. If not, then that sends a very dangerous message to those in the world and those who were involved in a part of this attack. We got more to come tonight. Stay with us.
In this world where people are staying at home, many of life's moments are being put on hold. At Carvana, we understand that for some, getting a car just can't wait. That's why the new way to buy and sell a car is also the safer way. At Carvana, you can do it all 100% online from home with a touchless delivery and pickup process to keep you safe. And for even greater peace of mind, all Carvana cars come with a 7-day return policy. So if you need to keep moving, it's our goal to keep you safe. Check out Carvana, the safer way to buy a car.
Welcome back. The attack on the Capitol and the president being impeached has overshadowed the coronavirus pandemic. Here in the United States, the situation is getting progressively worse. Nationwide, there are more than 23 million coronavirus cases and more than 396,000 coronavirus deaths. According to the COVID Tracking Project, there are more than 126,000 people hospitalized here in the United States. In Utah, today they reported 2,150 new coronavirus cases and 13 deaths. Also in Utah, the UK variant of the coronavirus, that strain was discovered in Utah on Friday. Vaccinations are continuing for teachers and the elderly right now in Utah. According to Becky Jacobs at the Salt Lake Tribune, Utah's coronavirus figures indicates a record number in ICUs. Earlier this week, the Intermountain Healthcare is a hospital in Utah, and they released this video from their YouTube channel about the coronavirus and one patient's experience grappling with this virus.
My name is Andrea Ballou. I work here at McKady Hospital as a registered nurse, and I've been here for about 2 years. I've been working on the COVID pandemic since March when it started. People don't understand is with COVID, it's not just hurting your lungs. Your entire body can go into organ failure. Essentially, your family members can die. I mean, it's a critical illness, and we don't know who's going to get it, and we don't know how bad they're going to get it. So my dad contracted it in July. I talked to him for about a week before every day to see how he was doing. The final day, he just said he wasn't breathing very well, so I told him that it was time to go to the hospital. He was afraid. For the first few weeks, I wasn't able to see him, and then I was able to see him, which made it hard because I felt the guilt that my mom couldn't see him and I could. He was on high flow oxygen for about 2 weeks and then they wanted to intubate. To be intubated, they're gonna put a tube down your throat and hook you to a ventilator, which is essentially gonna breathe for you. But we didn't know if he would come out of that. So it was a hard decision to make. Walking past his room when he was in there, I would find myself always peeking through the window just to make sure he was still doing okay. I found myself several times in the hallway and the stairwell crying, and it was just an emotional roller coaster. He stayed intubated, sedated, paralyzed for about 3 weeks. We made the decision to do a trach where they put a tube down through his windpipe and he'll be on the ventilator, breathe for him. And that allowed us to turn the sedation and the paralytics off. We had to send him to a rehab facility for respiratory rehab where he was there for a little over a month. Eventually he'll be able to walk and get around and do his daily needs. But right now he's just trying to get stronger so he can get out of bed, he can shave, he can brush his teeth and do all of your daily needs that we take for granted. So by the time we're done with it, it's gonna be a good 4 month hospital stay.
To be on the mend is a miracle. Yeah. Don't mix with crowds. Don't go with anybody you don't know. Because I don't know where I got this and I wasn't mixing.
My dad will be living with us when he gets out until they can get their situation figured out and his health is back to normal or somewhat normal. So it's just a new kind of normal for us right now. And we don't know what normal is going to be in the future.
Once again, that was a video released by the Intermountain Healthcare YouTube channel on a coronavirus story about a patient, which in the video you can hear about that healthcare worker saying that that patient is actually her dad. At the end of the video, the dad is encouraging people to avoid crowds because it is not worth it contracting this disease and also risking your life. in California, more than 40,000 new coronavirus cases were reported on Friday, and 669 people died. Right now, more than 20,000 people are hospitalized, and 4,750 are in the ICUs. Today, California Democratic Congressman Louis Correa announced that he has tested positive for COVID-19 after returning home from Washington, D.C. This, of course, is in relation to the attack that transpired at the U.S. Capitol when Republican members of Congress were offered masks but rejected them. You can see it in videos. I'll make sure to leave some of those in the description of this episode. Now, he is now the sixth member of Congress, the sixth Democratic member of Congress to contract the coronavirus after being at the Capitol last week when the insurrection occurred and Republican members of Congress were mocking Democratic members of Congress and not wearing masks. UC San Diego is reporting an exponential increase in student coronavirus cases just after the holiday break. According to Gary Robbins at the Los Angeles Times, quote, UC San Diego said that 245 of its students have tested positive for the coronavirus since the winter quarter began January 4th, the kind of surge that the university avoided last fall through a major testing and education campaign called Return to Learn. The school is saying that, end quote, UC San Diego is now saying that 109 of its students who tested positive live on campus, while the other 136 live off campus. Also, 61 employees have tested positive for the virus as well. The school released a statement saying, quote, our interpretation is that they acquired the virus in the community during the break. Going home during a raging pandemic is a dangerous thing. The on-campus case rate is now declining to pre-break levels as we work through the infections that came back from the winter break, end quote. The state of California is also now having a particularly hard time with the coronavirus vaccine. Today, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that California has nearly 2 million unused doses of the vaccine as even demand is now soaring for more vaccines, for more vaccinations. I'll leave that article in the description of this episode as well. The New York Times sort of picks up on that story and offers what is essentially, for anyone who is enraged or perplexed by this, rollout in California. Quote, Governor Gavin Newsom's announcement on Wednesday seemed sweeping. California would open eligibility for a coronavirus vaccine to anyone 65 or older, effectively abandoning a rollout plan that was meant to ensure the most vulnerable would be first in line. A day later, residents of the vast and varied state were trying to navigate what many declined as vaccination chaos, as what many described as vaccination chaos. Some counties shifted gears immediately, like Orange County, which said anyone 65 or older could book an appointment at the vaccination site it opened this week in Disneyland. But the scheduling website was quickly overwhelmed, making scheduling a shot seemed like trying to get tickets to a Taylor Swift concert. End quote. So things are obviously not going well there. And on top of that, today, Los Angeles County surpassed 1 million coronavirus cases. Right now in Los Angeles, one person dies from the coronavirus every 6 minutes. According to Alicia Lozano at NBC News, 10 people on average test positive for the coronavirus every minute in Los Angeles County. Vivian Ho reported at The Guardian today that 1 in 3 Los Angeles residents have been infected with COVID-19. Today, the United States recorded more than 201,000 new coronavirus cases and 3,353 deaths. Health experts are now saying that the domestic terrorist attack at the Capitol last week was a major super spreader event. President-elect Joe Biden has said that there will be a memorial to honor those who lost their lives due to COVID-19 just a day before he's sworn in. That vigil will be taking place on January 19th, next week. Also on Thursday this week, President-elect Joe Biden spoke about the vaccine rollout and a $1 trillion COVID-19 rescue plan.
I'd like to talk to you about our way forward, a two-step plan of rescue and recovery, a two-step plan to build a bridge to to the other side of the crisis we face to a better, stronger, more secure America. Tonight, I'll lay out my first step, the American Rescue Plan, that will tackle the pandemic and get direct financial assistance and relief to Americans who need it the most. Next month, my first appearance before a joint session of Congress, I will lay out my Build Back Better recovery plan. It'll make historic investments in infrastructure, that Build Back Better plan. Infrastructure, manufacturing, innovation, research and development, and clean energy. Investments in a caregiving economy and in skills and training needed by our workers to be able to compete and win in the global economy. The vaccine rollout in the United States has been a dismal failure thus far. Tomorrow, I will lay out our vaccination plan to correct course and meet our goal of 100 million shots at the end of my first 100 days as president. This will be one of the most challenging operational efforts we have ever undertaken as a nation. We'll have to move heaven and earth to get more people vaccinated, to create more places for them to get vaccinated, to mobilize more medical teams to get shots in people's arms, to increase vaccine supply, and to get it out the door as fast as possible. But we need about $400 billion in funding from Congress to make all of what I just said happen. It's a great deal, but I'm convinced we are ready to get this done. The very health of our nation is at stake.
Once again, President-elect Joe Biden speaking earlier this week about the coronavirus vaccine rollout, and also a $1 trillion COVID-19 vaccine plan. There are four more days to the presidential inauguration, January 20th, 2021. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
At a time when we're asked to sacrifice, we step up to do our part. On the home front, on the front lines, to lend a helping hand and hold each other up. We are resilient, vigilant, and we'll get through this because we're better together, even if we're a little farther apart.
Pop quiz. Who was Richard Nixon's personal lawyer? If you don't know, his name is Herbert Kalmbach. Listen to this part of my podcast, Disgrace. His name was Herbert Kalmbach, Richard Nixon's personal lawyer. After Nixon won the 1968 election, Kalmbach rejected an offer to be the Deputy Secretary of Commerce. Instead, he took a job making money as a real estate attorney. He represented corporate clients who hoped to cash in on his personal relationship with President Richard Nixon. Kalmbach was in charge of handling Nixon's income tax returns and also matters involving his home in San Clemente, California. Nixon considered Kalmbach to be trustworthy, discreet, and a close confidant. In fact, he had so much esteem for his friend and personal lawyer that he chose him to be the deputy finance chairman of the 1972 election campaign for Nixon. And this is where the story gets interesting. After that suspicious break-in at the DNC headquarters in June of 1972, Herbert Kalmbach, Richard Nixon's personal lawyer, was instructed to pay off one of the Watergate burglars, and he was supposed to do this through a bagman named Anthony Uliskiewicz, a former New York City police detective who was on the Nixon campaign's private payroll. In that particular payoff, it was unclear if the president was actually involved in it, but there were some other hush money schemes that Mr. Kalmbach participated in. We also know that he participated in a secret $500,000 financial sabotage scheme against the Democrats. Also, he funneled $220,000 to pay off the seven burglars implicated in the Watergate break-in. Then he donated $100,000 to a campaign that was ultimately unsuccessful in defeating independent segregationist Alabama Governor George Wallace. And it did not just end there. There were some other continued money payoff schemes that just continued, and there were more instances when this transpired. For instance, Sam Roberts reports at the New York Times, quote, "In another episode, after withdrawing $100,000 earmarked for the anti-Wallace effort from a safe deposit box, he hand-delivered the cash to a stranger in the lobby of the Sherry Netherland Hotel in New York, identifying himself as, quote, Mr. Jensen of Detroit," end quote. That was not the case. He was not Mr. Jensen of Detroit. he was definitely Herbert Kalmbach, Richard Nixon's personal lawyer, involved in illegal hush money schemes. Then, on January 1st, 1972, the Washington Post published a bombshell article. This was the headline, quote, "Bug suspect got campaign funds," end quote. So that was part of my podcast disgrace about this obscure character in the Watergate scandal called Herbert Kalmbach. No one actually really knows about Herbert Kalmbach, but Herbert Kalmbach was Richard Nixon's personal attorney. And of course, he ended up going to jail.
Kalmbach showed no emotion. He said, "I'd like you to know how deeply embarrassed I am and how sorry I am to be here." Judge Sirica announced the sentence. Not less than 6 months and not more than 18 months with a fine of $10,000. Kalmbach left the court and went straight to a waiting car without comment. He is the 14th person to be sentenced for a crime related to Watergate.
That was reporting from NBC News in the 1970s when Richard Nixon's personal lawyer, Herbert Kalmbach, went to jail. You could sort of compare that to right now. Michael Cohen is President Trump's former fixer and attorney. And Michael Cohen ultimately did go to jail as well, like Herbert Kalmbach. And Michael Cohen, just like Herbert Kalmbach, had unrelenting loyalty for his boss, President Richard Nixon. President Richard Nixon. And Michael Cohen also had unrelenting loyalty for his boss, Donald Trump. And both of these people ultimately did go to jail and cooperated with prosecutors. Well, now comes this. Earlier this week, we received reporting from multiple news organizations, including The Hill, The Associated Press, and Insider, also NBC News and other sources, that Michael Cohen is now cooperating with federal prosecutors about the president's finances. According to Yahoo News, prosecutors conducted an hours-long interview with Michael Cohen about Trump's finances. According to NBC News, quote, "President Donald Trump, former personal lawyer Michael Cohen said in a tweet on Friday that he is cooperating with officials probing the president and his family. Quote, I have been asked and have agreed to cooperate with multiple government agencies to provide testimony on the wrongdoing by Trump and the Trump family. I am doing this in large part as Trump and his family have tried and thankfully failed to destroy America's democracy." End quote. So once again, just this interesting new prospect that Michael Cohen is not cooperating with prosecutors like Herbert Kalmbach did. And just like Herbert Kalmbach during the Nixon era, Nixon was very quiet when it came to Herbert Kalmbach going to jail. Herbert Kalmbach said he felt very sad that the president was not even talking to him or providing him with words of comfort after all those years of that unrelenting loyalty until he was finally caught. And the same thing with Michael Cohen. The president just distanced himself from him. But once again, this new reporting that Michael Cohen conducted an hours-long interview with prosecutors about the Trump family and their finances. Thank you so very much for being with me here on this episode of the Jeremiah Patterson Show. I really appreciate it. Have a great day, and I will see you tomorrow.